There's nothing terribly wrong with the concept of using standardized testing to determine whether kids are learning to read and write and do math. But too many politicians and education bureaucrats have created a national obsession with testing, as if everything that's wrong with the educational system in this country could be magically fixed if we could just raise those scores. The people who really should be tested, beside the yammering pundits, are the so-called political leaders. Next time you see your state representative or congressman, give him this pop quiz and remind him that any future pay raises will be based on how well he scores. Number one, what is the annual pay of your average constituent? The answer, $28,548. Two, what percent of welfare recipients are children? The answer, 67%. Number three, how many known species of plants and animals are on the brink of extinction? Number three, answer, 11,046. Number four, how big is the hole in the ozone layer? Answer, 10.5 million square miles. Question five, which African countries have a lower infant mortality rate than Detroit? The answer, Libya, Mauritius, and the Seychelles. How many American cities still have two competing newspapers? The answer, 34. Number seven, how many ounces in a gallon? Answer, 128 ounces. Question eight, which do I stand a better chance of being killed by, a gun shot in school or a bolt of lightning? Answer, you're twice as likely to be killed by lightning as by a gunshot in school. Question nine, what's the only state capital without a McDonald's? Answer, Montpelier, Vermont. Question 10. Describe the story of either the Iliad or the Odyssey. The answer, the Iliad is an ancient Greek epic poem by Homer about the Trojan War. The Odyssey is another epic poem by Homer recounting the 10-year journey home from the Trojan War made by Odysseus, the king of Ithaca. Chances are the genius representing you in the legislature won't score 50% on the above test. The good news is that you get to flunk him within a year or two. There is one group in the country that isn't just sitting around carping about all them lame-brained teachers, a group that cares deeply about what kinds of students will enter the adult world. You could say they have a vested interest in this captive audience of millions of young people, or in the billions of dollars they spend each year. Teenagers alone spent more than $150 billion last year. Yes, it's corporate America, whose generosity to our nation's schools is just one more example of their continuing patriotic service. Just how committed are these companies to our children's schools? According to numbers collected by the Center for the Analysis of Commercialism in Education, their selfless charity has been a tremendous boom since 1990. Over the past 10 years, school programs and activities have seen corporate sponsorship increase by 248%. In exchange for this sponsorship, schools allow the corporation to associate its name with the events. For example, Eddie Bauer sponsors the final round of the National Geography Bee. Book covers featuring Calvin Klein and Nike ads are distributed to students. Nike and other shoemakers looking for early access to tomorrow's stars sponsor inner-city high school basketball teams. Pizza Hut set up its Book It program to encourage children to read. When students meet the monthly reading goal, they're rewarded with a certificate for a Pizza Hut personal pan pizza. At the restaurant, the store manager personally congratulates the children and gives them each a sticker and a certificate. Pizza Hut suggests school principals place a Pizza Hut Book It honor roll list in the school for everyone to see. General Mills and Campbell's Soups thought up a better plan. Instead of giving free rewards, they both have programs rewarding schools for getting parents to buy their products. Under General Mills' Box Tops for Education program, schools get 10 cents for each box top logo they send in and can earn up to $10,000 a year. That's 100,000 General Mills products sold. Campbell Soup's Labels for Education program is no better. It touts itself as providing America's children with free school equipment. Schools can earn one free Apple iMac computer for only 94,950 soup labels. Campbell suggests setting a goal of a label a day from each student. With Campbell's conservative estimate of 5 labels per week per child, all you need is a school of 528 kids to get that free computer. It's not just this kind of sponsorship that brings these schools and corporations together. The 1990s saw a phenomenal 1,384% increase in exclusive agreements between schools and soft drink bottlers. 240 school districts in 31 states have sold exclusive rights to one of the big three soda companies, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Dr. Pepper, to push their products in schools. Anyone wonder why there are more overweight kids than ever before? Or more young women with calcium deficiencies because they're drinking less milk? And even though federal law prohibits the sale of soft drinks in schools until lunch periods begin, in some overcrowded schools, lunch begins in mid-morning. Artificially flavored carbonated sugar water. The breakfast of champions. In March 2001, Coke responded to public pressure, announcing that it would add water, juice, and other sugar-free, caffeine-free, and calcium-rich alternatives to soda in its school vending machines. I guess they can afford such concessions when you consider their deal with the Colorado Springs School District. Colorado has been a trailblazer when it comes to tie-ins between the schools and soft drink companies. In Colorado Springs, the district will receive $8.4 million over 10 years from its deal with Coca-Cola, and more if it exceeds its requirement of selling 70,000 cases of Coke products a year. To ensure the levels are met, school district officials urged principals to allow students unlimited access to Coke machines and allow students to drink Coke in the classroom. But Coke isn't alone. In the Jefferson County, Colorado School District, home of Columbine High School, Pepsi contributed $1.5 million to help build a new sports stadium. Some county schools tested a science course developed in part by Pepsi called the Carbonated Beverage Company. Students taste-tested colas, analyzed cola samples, watched a video tour of a Pepsi bottling plant, and visited a local plant. The school district in Wiley, Texas, signed a deal in 1996 that shared the rights to sell soft drinks in the schools between Coke and Dr. Pepper. Each company paid $31,000 a year. Then, in 1998, the county changed its mind and signed a deal with Coke worth $1.2 million over 15 years. Dr. Pepper sued the county for breach of contract. The school district bought out Dr. Pepper's contract, costing them $160,000 plus another $20,000 in legal fees. It's not just the companies that sometimes get sent packing. Students who lack the proper corporate school spirit do so at considerable risk. When Mike Cameron wore a Pepsi shirt on Coke Day at Greenbrier High School in Evans, Georgia, he was suspended for a day. Coke Day was part of the school's entry in a national team-up with Coca-Cola contest, which awards $10,000 to the high school that comes up with the best plan for distributing Coke discount cards. Greenbrier school officials said Cameron was suspended for being disruptive in trying to destroy the school picture when he removed an outer shirt and revealed the Pepsi shirt as a photograph was being taken of students posed to spell out the word Coke. Cameron said the shirt was visible all day, but he didn't get in trouble until posing for the picture. No slouch in the marketing department, Pepsi quickly sent the high school senior a box of Pepsi shirts and hats. If turning the students into billboards isn't enough, schools and corporations sometimes turn the school itself into one giant neon sign for corporate America. Appropriation of school space, including scoreboards, rooftops, walls, and textbooks for corporate logos and advertising, is up 539%. Colorado Springs, not satisfied to sell its soul only to Coca-Cola, has plastered its school buses with advertisements for Burger King, Wendy's, and other big companies. Free book covers and school planners with ads for Kellogg's Pop-Tarts, and pictures of Fox TV personalities were also handed out to the students. After members of the Grapevine-Colleyville Independent School District in Texas decided they didn't want advertisements in the classrooms, they allowed Dr. Pepper and 7-Up logos to be painted on the rooftops of two high schools. The two high schools, not coincidentally, lie under the Dallas Airport flight path. The schools aren't just looking for ways to advertise. They're also concerned with the students' perceptions of various products. That's why, in some schools, companies conduct market research in classrooms during school hours. Education Market Resources of Kansas reports that children respond openly and easily to questions and stimuli in the classroom setting. Of course, that's what they're supposed to be doing in a classroom, but for their own benefit, not that of some corporate pollsters. Filling out marketing surveys instead of learning, however, is probably not what they should be doing. Companies have also learned they can reach this confined audience by sponsoring educational materials. This practice, like the others, has exploded as well, increasing 1,875% since 1990. Teachers have shown a Shell oil video that teaches students that the way to experience nature is by driving there, after filling your Jeep's gas tank at a Shell station. ExxonMobil prepared lesson plans about the flourishing wildlife in Prince William Sound, site of the ecological disaster caused by the oil spill from the Exxon Valdez. A third grade math book features exercises involving counting Tootsie Rolls. A Hershey's-sponsored curriculum used in many schools features the Chocolate Dream Machine, including lessons in math, science, geography, and nutrition. In a number of high schools, the economics course is supplied by General Motors. GM writes and provides the textbooks and the course outline. Students learn from GM's example the benefits of capitalism and how to operate a company, like GM. And what better way to imprint a corporate logo on the country's children than through television and the internet beamed directly into the classroom? Electronic marketing, where a company provides programming or equipment to schools for the right to advertise to their students, is up 139%. One example is the ZapMe Corporation, which provides schools with a free computer lab and access to pre-selected websites. In return, schools must promise that the lab will be in use at least 4 hours a day. The catch? The ZapMe web browser has constantly scrolling advertisements, and the company gets to collect information on students' browsing habits, information they can then sell to other companies. Perhaps the worst of the electronic marketers is Channel One Television. 8 million students in 12,000 classrooms watch Channel One, an in-school news and advertising program every day. That's right, every day. Kids are spending the equivalent of 6 full school days a year watching Channel One in almost 40% of the U.S. middle and high schools. Instructional time lost to the ads alone? 1 entire day per year. That translates into an annual cost to taxpayers of more than $1.8 billion. Sure, doctors and educators agree that our kids can never watch enough TV. And there's probably a place in school for some television programs. I have fond memories of watching astronauts blasting off on the television rolled into my grade school auditorium. But out of the daily 12-minute Channel One broadcasts, only 20% of the airtime is devoted to stories about politics, the economy, and cultural and social issues. That leaves a whopping 80% for advertising, sports, weather, features, and Channel One promotions. Channel One is disproportionately shown in schools in low-income communities with large minority populations, where the least money is available for education and where the least amount is spent on textbooks and other academic materials. Once these districts receive corporate handouts, government's failure to provide adequate school funding tends to remain unaddressed. There's an irony, if there ever was one. Going to participate in democracy's sacred ritual while 2,000 students in the same building live under some sort of totalitarian dictatorship. The halls are packed with burned-out teenagers shuffling from class to class, dazed and confused, wondering what the hell they're doing there. They learn how to regurgitate answers the state wants them to give, and any attempt to be an individual is now grounds for being suspected to be a member of the trench coat mafia. I visited a school recently, and some students asked me if I noticed that they and the other students in the school were all wearing white or some neutral color. Nobody dares wear black or anything else wild and distinct. That's a sure ticket to the principal's office, where the school psychologist will be waiting to ascertain whether that Limp Bizkit shirt you have on means that you intend to shoot up Miss Nelson's fourth-hour geometry class. So the kids learn to submerge any personal expression. They learn that it's better to go along so that you get along. They learn that to rock the boat could get them rocked right out of the school. Don't question authority. Do as you're told. Don't think. Just do as I say. Oh, and have a good and productive life as an active, well-adjusted participant in our thriving democracy. How to be a student subversive instead of a student subservient. There are many ways you can fight back at your high school and have fun while doing it. The key thing is to learn what all the rules are and what your rights are by law and by school district policy. This will help prevent you getting in the kind of trouble you don't need. It may also get you some cool perks. David Shankula, a college student who has helped me on this book, recalls that when he was in high school in Kentucky, he and his buddies found some obscure state law that said any student who requests a day off to go to the state fair must be given the day off. The state legislature probably passed this law years ago to help some farm kid take his prize hog to the fair without being penalized at school. But the law was still on the books, and it gave any student the right to request the state fair day off, regardless of the reason. So you can imagine the look on the principal's face when David and his city friends submitted their request for their free day off from school. And there was nothing the principal could do. Here are a few more things you can do. 1. Mock the vote. Student council and class elections are the biggest smokescreen the school throws up, fostering the illusion that you actually have any say in the running of the school. Most students who run for these offices either take the charade too seriously or they just think it'll look good on their college applications. So why not run yourself? Run just to ridicule the whole ridiculous exercise. Form your own party with its own stupid name. Campaign on wild promises. If elected, I'll change the school mascot to an amoeba. Or, if elected, I'll insist that the principal must first eat the school lunch each day before it is fed to the students. Put up banners and cool slogans. Vote for me, a real loser. If you get elected, you can devote your energies to accomplishing things that will drive the administration crazy, but help out your fellow students. Demands for free condoms, student evaluations of teachers, less homework so you can get to bed by midnight, etc. 2. Start a school club. You have a right to do this. Find a sympathetic teacher to sponsor it. The Pro-Choice Club, the Free Speech Club, the Integrate Our Town Club. Make every member a president of the club so they all can claim it on their college applications. One student I know tried to start a feminist club, but the principal wouldn't allow it, because then they'd be obliged to give equal time to a male chauvinist club. That's the kind of idiot thinking you'll encounter, but don't give up. Heck, if you find yourself in that situation, just say fine, and suggest that the principal could sponsor the chauvinist club. 3. Launch your own newspaper or webzine. You have a constitutional protected right to do this. If you take care not to be obscene or libelous, or give them any reason to shut you down, this can be a great way to get the truth out about what's happening at your school. Use humor. The students will love it. 4. Get involved in the community. Go to the school board meetings and inform them what's going on in the school. Petition them to change things. They will try to ignore you or make you sit through a long, boring meeting before they let you speak, but they have to let you speak. Write letters to the editor of your local paper. Adults don't have a clue about what goes on in your high school. Fill them in. More than likely, you'll find someone out there who'll support you. Any or all of this will raise quite a ruckus, but there's help out there if you need it. Contact the local American Civil Liberties Union if the school retaliates. Threaten lawsuits. School administrators hate to hear that word. Just remember, there's no greater satisfaction than seeing the look on your principal's face when you have the upper hand. Use it. And never forget this. There is no permanent record. Guide to Student Rights. As an American student, you probably haven't learned much about the U.S. Constitution or about your civil rights. So here's a handy guide based on information from the American Civil Liberties Union. The First Amendment of the Constitution guarantees the right to free expression and free association. And according to the United States Supreme Court, these rights even apply to you, the lowly student, at least some of the time. In 1969, the Supreme Court, in Tinker versus Des Moines Independent Community School District, ruled that the First Amendment applies to students in public schools. Private schools have more leeway to set their own rules on free expression because they are not operated by the government. Public school students can express their opinions orally and in writing, in leaflets or on buttons, armbands, or T-shirts, as long as they do not materially and substantially disrupt classes or other school activities. School officials can probably prohibit students from using vulgar or indecent language, but they cannot censor only one side of a controversy. If you and other students produce your own newspaper and want to hand it out in school, administrators cannot censor you or prohibit distribution of the paper, unless it is indecent or handing it out disrupt school activities. But administrators can censor what appears in the official school paper, the one that is published with school money. In the 1988 decision, Hazelwood School District versus Kuhlmeier, the United States Supreme Court held that public school administrators can censor student speech in official school publications or activities, like a school play, art exhibit, yearbook, or newspaper, if the officials think students are saying something inappropriate or harmful, even if it is not vulgar and does not disrupt any activity. Some states, including Colorado, California, Iowa, Kansas, and Massachusetts, have high school free expression laws that give students expanded free speech rights. Check with your local ACLU to find out if your state has such laws. Are you a potential school shooter? The following is a list of traits the FBI has identified as risk factors among students who may commit violent acts. Stay away from any student showing signs of poor coping skills, access to weapons, depression, drug and alcohol abuse, alienation, narcissism, inappropriate humor, unlimited, unmonitored television and internet use. Since this includes all of you, drop out of school immediately. Homeschooling is not a viable option because you must also stay away from yourself. Important dates in history. June 19, 1865. Juneteenth. Although the Emancipation Proclamation had freed the slaves 2 years earlier, the word hadn't gotten to everyone in the South. On this day, in Galveston, Texas, a Union general arrived and officially informed the slaves of their freedom. December 29, 1890. Massacre at Wounded Knee. As part of one last effort to quell the one remaining Indian rebellion, U.S. troops were sent out to arrest Bigfoot, the chief of the Sioux Indian tribe. Members of the tribe were captured, forced to give up their arms, and moved into a camp surrounded by the U.S. troops. On the morning of December 29th, the soldiers opened fire on the Indian camp, and 300 unarmed Sioux, including Bigfoot, were killed. It was the last battle in the 400-year campaign of genocide against the Native Americans. May 18, 1896. In Plessy versus Ferguson, the U.S. Supreme Court decided that inferior accommodations for blacks on railroad cars did not constitute a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The decision paved the way for the separate but equal policies that resulted in Jim Crow laws. April 14, 1914, the Ludlow Massacre. Colorado coal miners who had been trying for years to unionize went on strike. After being kicked out of their company-owned homes, the strikers and their families set up tent colonies on public property. On the morning of April 14th, Colorado militiamen and other strikebreakers fired their guns into the camp and burned down the tents, killing 20, mostly women and children. March 22, 1947. President Truman issued Executive Order 9835 to identify the infiltration of disloyal persons within the government. This ushered in an era of fear and paranoia about alleged communists that led to more than 6 million people being investigated and 500 being dismissed from their jobs for questionable loyalty. December 1, 1955. A tired seamstress and local civil rights activist in Montgomery, Alabama, Rosa Parks, refused to give up her seat on a bus to a white passenger. This quiet act launched the Montgomery bus boycott, which lasted for 381 days and established Martin Luther King Jr. as the movement's leader. The boycott was ended after the Supreme Court ruled that segregation laws on public transportation were illegal. April 30, 1975, the fall of Saigon. Although American ground troops had officially pulled out of Vietnam 2 years earlier, the day represents the end of the brutal war. Several weeks of chaos over the impending communist takeover culminated in a desperate scene as the last of the United States rescue helicopters took off from the American embassy's rooftop with the few refugees they could carry. Chapter 6, Nice Planet, Nobody Home. I'd like to begin this chapter by revealing what I believe is one of the greatest threats currently facing our environment. Me. That's right. I'm a walking ecological nightmare. I am the mother of all Bhopals. Now, let's start with this. I don't recycle. I think recycling is like going to church. You show up once a week, it makes you feel good, and you've done your duty. Then you can get back to all the fun of sinning. Let me ask you this. Do you honestly know where all those newspapers go after you drop them off at the recycling center? Or where your soda pop bottles end up after you put them in the blue recycling containers? To some facility that will recycle them? Says who? Have you ever followed the truck that picks up your recyclables to see where it goes? Do you care? Is it enough for you to separate your glass from your plastic, your paper from your metals, and then leave the follow-through to someone else? I will never cease to be amazed at the lemming-like nature of human beings and our unquestioning obedience to authority. If the sign says recycle, we do our part and assume everything we put in there will be recycled. If the trash can is blue, we figure that's a surefire guarantee that the glass jars we place in there will be crushed, melted down, and made into new bottles of ragu. Well, think again. One night, coming home late from work, I witnessed the garbage men tossing those earnestly clear blue garbage bags full of glass into their truck's crusher, along with all the other garbage. I asked the guy who works in our building if that was normal. Oh, they got a lot of garbage to pick up, he said. Sometimes they don't have time to separate everything. I wonder if this was just an anomaly or the norm. Here's a few things I found out. In the mid-1990s, Indian environmental activists discovered that Pepsi was creating a complicated waste disposal problem in their country. Used plastic from Pepsi bottles, turned in for recycling in the United States, was being shipped over to India to be recycled back into Pepsi bottles or other plastic containers. But the senior manager of the Futura Industry factory outside of Madras, where most of the waste was being dumped, admitted that much of it was never actually recycled. To make matters worse, at around the same time the truth about the recycling was revealed, the company announced that it was going to open a company in India that would manufacture, of course, single-use disposable bottles for export to the United States and Europe, leaving toxic byproducts behind in India. So while India has been bearing the environmental and health burdens, consumers in industrialized countries continue using plastic products without suffering any of the drawbacks. And all the while, we consumers cruise blissfully along, confident that we're improving the environment by recycling. In another instance, a magazine in San Francisco contracted with a paper recycler to pick up all its white waste paper each month. When one employee followed the trash out the door one day, he saw that the paper intended for recycling was being tossed in with the discarded McDonald's wrappers and Starbucks cups. When confronted about it, the waste recycling company denied it. In 1999, an investigation of what happens to all the waste created by Congress, insert your own joke here, discovered that 71% of the 2,670 tons of paper used that year by the legislative branch was not recycled because it had been mixed in with food waste and other non-recyclable materials. That same year, up to 5,000 tons of glass bottles, aluminum cans, cardboard, and other recyclable waste on Capitol Hill was simply dumped in a landfill. No questions asked. Had Congress properly recycled these products, it could have saved taxpayers up to $700,000. In instance after instance, I found the same thing. No real recycling was taking place. We were being conned. So I stopped recycling. I came to the conclusion that when I recycled, what I was really doing was letting myself off the hook. As long as I did my little paper, glass, metal separation duty, I wasn't required to do anything else to save planet Earth. Once my bottles and cans and newspapers were deposited in the appropriately colored barrels, I could press reset on my conscience and trust that someone else would do the rest of the job. Out of sight, out of mind, back inside my gas-guzzling minivan. Yes, I have a minivan. It gets about 15 miles a gallon, about 7 less than what the sticker said. I love this minivan. It's roomy, has a smooth ride, and sits a foot above the cars in front of me so I can see everything. I know some people say we Americans are spoiled by our low prices at the gas pump compared with the rest of the world, which pays up to 3 times what we pay. But hey, this ain't Belgium, where you can drive across the entire country in something like 35 minutes. We live in a huge nation. We need to get around. We got places to go, things to do. The rest of the world needs to understand that they benefit from our ability to get from point A to point B. How else are hard-working Americans supposed to get from their first job of the day to their second job at night, which is all part of a greater plan to create a global economy, if they don't have wheels? See, I come from Flint, Michigan, the vehicle city, not to be confused with the motor city. We're an hour north of Detroit, and at one time my hometown built every Buick in the world. They don't build Buicks there anymore. Growing up immersed in a car culture, you come to see your car as an extension of yourself. Your car is your stereo room, your dining room, your bedroom, your home theater, your office, your reading room, and the first place you do just about anything in your life that means anything. When I became an adult, I decided I didn't want a General Motors car, mainly because they broke down more often than I did. So I bought Volkswagens and Hondas and drove them around town with pride. If anyone asked me why I didn't buy American, I'd make them open their hood and show them the Made in Brazil plate on their engine, the Made in Mexico lettering on their fan belt, and the Made in Singapore label on their radio. Other than the tag on the dashboard implying the entire car was made in America, what exactly could they point to in their car that actually gave a job to anyone in Flint? My Honda Civic never broke down. For 8 years and 115,000 miles, I never had it in the shop for any reason other than regularly scheduled maintenance. The day it died, I was broke and on unemployment and stuck in the middle of Pennsylvania Avenue, about 4 blocks from the White House. I just got out, pushed it over to the curb, removed the plates, and bid it farewell. I didn't buy another car for 9 years. Working most of the time in New York City, I didn't need one. thanks to the city's fine mass transportation system and reliable taxi drivers, but because I spend a lot of time back home in Michigan, I got tired of renting from Avis and broke down and bought a Chrysler minivan. This much I'll say. You'll never see me stuff myself like a sausage by driving around one of those little tin cans again. The internal combustion engine has done more to create global warming than anything else on the planet. Almost half the pollutants in our air come from the stuff that spews out of your car, and that air pollution is the cause of some 200,000 deaths per year. Global warming is jacking up the world's temperature year after year, which can cause increased risk of drought in some countries and have dangerous effects on agriculture and health. We're perilously close to creating a horrible calamity if we don't figure out how to turn down the heat. But you should see how this minivan handles. And it's so quiet inside, that is, until I crank up my corn on the combination CD tape surround sound deck, complete with 8 bitchin' speakers. I can drive 400 miles straight with music cranked, the air conditioning cranked, the hands-free satellite phone ready to take that all-important call from Rupert Murdoch, thanking me for the fine work on this book and letting me know that my execution has been moved up to Thursday so as not to conflict with America's wackiest school shooting videos. Detroit has proved it has the technology to mass-produce cars that get 45 miles per gallon and trucks and vans that get 35 miles per gallon. The year the auto companies reported their best gas mileage, 1987, during the reign of Ronald Reagan, the average car got 26 miles per gallon. Yet after the 8 years of eco-friendly Bill Clinton, who promised that cars would be getting 40 miles per gallon by the end of his presidency, the average miles per gallon for vehicles went down to 24.7. General Motors threw a lavish party in Washington for Clinton's 1993 inauguration. I guess it's just impolite to upset the host of a party given in your honor. Clinton's greatest gift to the big three automakers was exempting SUVs from the mileage requirements of regular passenger cars. Because of this exemption, these gas gluttons use up an extra 280,000 barrels of fuel each day. That fuel demand is one of the reasons the Bush administration is pushing to drill in the Arctic National Preserve in Alaska. Bush says the drilling will give us an extra 580,000 barrels of oil each day, enough to double the number of SUVs on the road. And yet consider, if SUVs had been forced by Clinton to meet the same gas mileage standards my minivan meets, an improvement of only a few miles per gallon, Bush would have no justification for drilling in Alaska. With all these SUVs on the road, I can no longer see over the vehicle in front of me. They're so big and intimidating, they're like a midget 18-wheeler on crack. What exactly is the point of an SUV? Initially, they were developed to give one the ability to drive in the middle of nowhere where there are no roads. I understand how that might make sense in Montana, but what the hell are all these yuppies doing inside them charging down a crowded street in Manhattan? How to use less gas. Hitchhike. It's free. You get to meet new people and have interesting conversations. Bonus feature? Strong likelihood of being featured in a supporting role on America's Most Wanted, or in a Lifetime Woman in Danger made-for-TV movie. Live in a city with mass transit. But please don't come to New York City. It's already way too crowded. Try another American city with extensive, dependable mass transit forget it. Come to New York. I've got an extra room you can stay with me. Siphon gas from cars parked at airports. They're not going anywhere. It's a shame to have all that gas just sitting there going to waste in these waste-conscious times. Plus, it's a safety hazard. Just imagine what would happen if a plane were to crash into one of those airport parking lots with thousands of parked cars filled to the brim with highly explosive petrol. Just don't swallow. Drive behind large semi-trucks so your wind drag is reduced. Highway safety experts may advise against this practice, but it works. You can put the car on cruise and just sit back and enjoy the scenery. Drawback? You may find yourself in a remote truck stop having the crap beaten out of you by a guy with a tattoo on his forehead that says, "Itch me." Live in your office or place of work. Eliminates both the gas-guzzling commute and annoying monthly rent payments. Bonus, you'll impress the boss by always being the first one in and the last to leave. In June of 2001, a panel of top American scientists reported that global warming was a real problem, and it was getting worse. In their study, requested by the Bush 2 White House, the group of 11 leading atmospheric scientists, including several who were previously skeptical about the scope of the problem, concluded that human activity is largely responsible for the warming of the Earth's atmosphere, and that we're in serious trouble as a result. The release of the study put George, I sleep just fine Bush, in a tough spot. He and other members of his administration had pointedly avoided using the phrase global warming, and had repeatedly expressed doubts about the idea that air pollution was heating the atmosphere in dangerous ways. Bush also outraged international leaders in July of 2001 when he rejected the Kyoto Protocol, a pact originally negotiated by more than 160 nations, including the United States, and designed to reduce global warming. But now, Bush's own scientists were saying the Earth was on its way to a major catastrophe. Well, I don't know. Maybe young George has a point on this one. After all, I like it warm. Coming from Michigan, land of brutal winters and three-week summer, I kind of enjoy this more temperate climate. Ask people if they'd rather have a nice scorching hot day at the beach or a bitter frigid Alberta clipper that makes their tongues stick to their teeth. And I'll bet you 9 out of 10 Americans already have their shades on and the portable Weber in the trunk. So what if you need sunscreen that says 125 SPF? Last summer, though, something happened that I found slightly shocking. The New York Times reported that for the first time in recorded history, the North Pole had melted. A shipload of scientists boated right up to the top of the world, and the ice was gone. The news induced such panic that within days the Times ran a correction, trying to reassure us. It wasn't really melted, just a little squishy. Right. I remember the last time they tried to quiet things down, back in the 1990s, when they told us about the big asteroid that was heading for a collision with Earth sometime in the next 20 years. Again, they took it back immediately. But they should know we can see right through that kind of withdrawal. The powers that be are never going to tell us when the end is nigh, given the risk of mask pandemonium and subscription cancellations it would cause. The last ice age was the result of a global temperature change of only 9 degrees. Right now, we're halfway there. Some experts are predicting a rise in temperature of 10.4 degrees just in the next century. In Venezuela, 4 of the country's 6 glaciers have melted since 1972. The fabled snows of Kilimanjaro are almost gone. When the lighthouse at Cape Hatteras was built in 1870, it was 1,500 feet from the shore. By now, the tide has risen to within 160 feet of it, and the lighthouse has had to be moved further inland. A melting of the polar ice caps could cause the oceans to rise by up to 30 feet, in effect wiping out every coastal city there is and taking out the entire state of Florida, voting booths and all. I realize places like New York and Los Angeles could use a good scrubbing, but 3 stories of salt water over the whole island of Manhattan wasn't what I had in mind. How to survive global warming. Identify common household objects that could serve as flotation devices once the ice caps melt. Give special attention to items made of synthetic materials, which tend to be extremely water resistant. Don't forget to look outside, too. Those waterproof chairs with built-in cup holders will float just as well in the ocean as in your backyard pool. Who says catastrophic polar meltdown can't be fun? Examine topographical maps of your area to determine highest elevation. Map out quickest route there. Hold escape drills. Invest in Ziploc bags and those yellow waterproof cameras. Contact your local YMCA about swimming lessons. Take lessons now. Pay special attention to instructions for treading water. Change your vacation plans from Florida to Montana. Tell your kids to switch their spring break alcohol binge from Daytona Beach to Boise. Speaking of Florida, that state can also be held responsible for this sorry mess. Why? Ask Mr. Freon. Before air conditioning, Florida and the rest of the South were lightly populated. The heat and humidity were unbearable. I mean, you can hardly move on a 100-degree day in Texas. The air is so thick in New Orleans, you can hardly breathe. No wonder people down south spoke with such an unintelligible drawl. It was just too damn hot to form a series of vowels and consonants. I believe this brutal, paralyzing heat is also the reason no great inventions, no great ideas, and no contributions toward advancing our civilization ever came out of the South, with a few notable exceptions, Lillian Hellman, William Faulkner, R.J. Reynolds. When it's that hot, who can think, let alone read? Then the air conditioner was invented, and suddenly you could actually get some work done in the South. Skyscrapers went up all over the region, and Northerners, sick of the winter, came down in droves. They found that you could drive to work in your air-conditioned car, work all day in your air-conditioned office, study all day in your air-conditioned college. Then you could go home at night to your air-conditioned house and plan the weekend's cross-burning and block club barbecue. Before we knew it, the South had risen and was now controlling the country. Today, the conservative ideology that was born in the Confederate South has the nation in its grip, mandating that the Ten Commandments be posted in public places, teaching creationism, insisting on prayer in school, banning books, fomenting hatred of the federal, northern, government, calling for reduction of government and social services, thirsting to go to war at a moment's notice, and looking to resolve any problem through violence. These are all trademarks of the elected lawmakers of the New South. If you think about it, the Confederacy has finally won the Civil War, a long-awaited victory won by luring stupid Yankees down there with a promise of 5,000 BTUs and a built-in ice maker. Now the South reigns supreme, and if you still don't believe it, just look at our last four presidential elections. If you wanted to win, you had to have been born in the South or adopted it as your home. In fact, in the last 10 presidential elections, the winner, or Supreme Court appointee, was the one with his feet planted most firmly in the South or West. No longer can anyone from the North get elected to lead the nation. Things the South was right about. Just to balance my portrait of the South as a land of sweat-stained clansters and latter-day corporate outposts, I've been asked to come up with a list of things we are thankful to the South for giving us. Here it is. Beef jerky. Lemonade. Fancy balls. Good manners. Country music. Napping in hammocks. Beauty queens. Michael Jordan. Walmart. Alligator wrestling. Walt Disney World. Air conditioning made it all possible. And now, having opened the door to Southern Pals and Dixie Climes, it's also promising to export those hot southern winds all over the world by making the hole in the ozone layer a reality. That hole is now over Antarctica and is 2.5 times the size of Europe. The ozone layer in the Earth's atmosphere protects us from ultraviolet radiation, which can give us cancer and kill us. The hole we've ripped in its fabric is caused by chlorinated fluorocarbons, chemicals typically used in air conditioners and refrigerators and as propellants in aerosol cans. When these chemicals are released into the atmosphere and struck by high-energy light waves such as ultraviolet light, they form compounds that destroy ozone. The biggest contributor of ozone-depleting CFCs? Car air conditioning units. One of America's favorite traveling companions. Which reminds me of another literally indispensable accessory du jour for hip young Americans on the go, bottled water. Why drink water out of a tap or fountain for free when you can pay $1.20 for the same thing and get a plastic bottle you can pretend to recycle later? I didn't always drink bottled water in New York. In fact, I used to put faith in the folk legend that New York's water supply is among the cleanest in the world. The water itself, I learned, is collected and stored in 22 open-air reservoirs in the Catskills and Upper Hudson River area and brought down to the city through an elaborate aqueduct system. It all sounded so pristine. But one night, at a party at a friend's house, an acquaintance remarked that he and his family try to get up to our cabin on the Croton Reservoir every chance we get. I asked, "How can you have a cabin on the shores of our drinking water?" "Oh, it's not right on the reservoir. It's across the road." You mean there's a highway that surrounds the water we drink? What about all the runoff from the road, all those oil spills and tire shavings and the like?" "Oh, they sterilize everything once the water gets to New York City," he replied. "You can't sterilize anything once it gets here," I protested. "By the time it gets to New York, it must already have every known germ-killing agent available to mankind already in full battle mode." He then went on to rhapsodize about how wonderful it is to boat around the reservoir. "Boat?" I cried. "You're boating in my drinking water?" "Oh, sure. Fishing, too. The state lets us keep our boat right on the shore." That was when the cases of Evian began entering my apartment. Of course, the downside of drinking bottled water, other than the outrageous cost, is that, like the recycling bins, it prevents me from giving a moment's further notice to the state of our water in America. As long as I can sell enough books to afford my French spring water, why should I waste my time worrying about the PCBs General Electric has dumped in the Hudson River? After all, hundreds of years ago, the Indians dumped their refuse into the Hudson, and the early white settlers used the river as a nonstop sewage drain. And look at the great metropolis they went on to create. How to be sure your drinking water is safe? Lobby Congress to make bottled water the nation's official beverage. Reroute and connect city water pipelines direct to the sources of spring water used by commercial bottlers. If that means running feeder pipelines under the Atlantic to tap into some pure alpine water, so be it. We ran a telephone cable under the ocean. Surely we can lay a pipe beside it to quench our thirst. Manhattan is also a great place to get a steak. Until a few years ago, I don't think there was a day in my adult life when I didn't eat beef, and often twice a day. Then, for no distinct reason, one day, I just stopped eating it. I went a full 4 years without a morsel of cow passing my lips. I have to say, those were the four healthiest years I've ever had. Note, guys like me define healthy as I didn't die. Maybe it was just hearing Oprah Winfrey say on her show back in 1996 that learning about mad cow disease just stopped me cold from eating another burger. Of course, Oprah then had to contend with a threat that was equally dangerous. The Texas cattleman who sued her, and the former rancher and beef lobbyist who appeared on the show to speak about the dangers of mad cow disease for $12 million. They claimed that Oprah and Howard Lyman violated a Texas statute that prohibits the false disparagement of perishable food products. Please note that it was Oprah who said she was stopped cold from eating another burger, not me, because, again, nobody here wants to be sued. Oprah won the lawsuit in 1998, then, just to mess with their heads in Texas, she declared, "I'm still off hamburgers." I, on the other hand, have unfortunately fallen off the chuck wagon, nibbling every now and then on poor Elsie. You'd think I would have learned my lesson back in the mid-70s when instead of eating beef, I ate fire retardant. Like millions of Michiganders, I spent a year ingesting PBB, the chemical used in kids' pajamas, and didn't even know it. The PBB came in the form of a product called Firemaster, manufactured by a company that also happened to make cattle feed. At one point, they accidentally mixed up the bags they poured the stuff into and sent the fire retardant, labeled as feed, to a big centralized operation in Michigan that distributed the feed to farms all over the state. Soon the cows were eating PBB, and we were eating the cows and drinking their milk, full of PBB. The problem with PBB is that the body doesn't excrete it or eliminate it in any way. It just stays in your stomach and digestive system. When this fiasco was uncovered and we learned that the state of Michigan had tried to keep the news from the public, the residents of Michigan flipped out. Heads rolled, politicians were thrown out of office, and we were told that scientists had no idea what the PBB would do to us, and we probably wouldn't find out for another 25 years. Well, the quarter-century fuse has run out, and I guess the good news is that my stomach has never caught on fire. But I'm still sitting here full of anxiety, waiting for the other hoof to drop. I can't help thinking about Centralia, Pennsylvania, the town where residents continued about their daily business while underground fires raged on nonstop for years. Science does not have an answer for everything. Are millions of Michiganders fixing to develop fleece-lined cancers and kick the milk bucket? Or will we just lose our minds and find ourselves working for a candidate who can't win but can do a lot of collateral damage? I don't have the answers. Neither does anyone else. If you know a native Michigander, and I guarantee there's one within shouting distance of you right now, thanks to the Reagan-sponsored diaspora of our people in the 1980s, ask her about PBB and see the ashen look that crosses her face. It's the dirty little secret we don't like to discuss. But there's a much greater bovine threat afoot among us today, one that knows no state or regional boundaries, one that deserves the Poeian moniker it wears like a bell around the neck. Mad cow. This is truly the scariest threat the human race has ever faced. Worse than AIDS. Worse than the Black Plague. Worse than not flossing. Mad cow disease has no cure. It has no preventive vaccine. Everyone who gets it dies without exception. A gruesomely painful death. And the worst part is that this is a man-made disease, born of a moment of human madness when we took innocent cows and turned them into cannibals. Here's how it started. Two researchers went to Papua New Guinea to study the effects of human cannibalism and how it made many Papuans go insane. They discovered that what these people were suffering from was a transmissible, spongiform, encephalopathic disease, or TSE. The native people called it kuru. What happens in TSE is that rogue proteins, prions, latch onto brain cells and twist into abnormal shapes. Instead of breaking down the way a good protein is supposed to do, these guys hang out and make a mess of your nervous tissue, leaving your brain full of holes like a wheel of well-aged Swiss. Turns out that in Papua New Guinea, these prions were being spread by cannibalism. No one seems to know where these prions originally came from, but when they get into your system, they wreak havoc. Some suggest that a mere speck of prion-infected meat, only the size of a peppercorn, is enough to infect a cow. Once the little buggers are released from the beef you've ingested, they spread like an army of Pac-Men, heading straight for your brain and devouring everything in sight. And here's the unbelievable part. You can't kill them because they're not alive. The disease first entered the food chain in Britain through sheep, then spread to cows when they were fed ground-up body parts of their fellow sheep and cows. Ultimately, the diseased beef was sold to the British public. The disease may lie dormant for up to 30 years before it unleashes its holy hell. Only after the deaths of 10 young people in 1996 did the British government acknowledge that something was wrong with the meat supply, something they had suspected for 10 years. The British solution for eradicating the source of the disease is to destroy any cow suspected of kuru, or mad cow disease, by cremation. But when you burn them, the threat doesn't disappear. You can't kill them, as I said. The smoke and ash just carry them to another location, setting them free to find their way once again to the British dinner table. Americans are not immune from this deadly disease. Some experts estimate that some 200,000 U.S. citizens diagnosed with Alzheimer's may, in fact, be carrying the alien protein and that their dementia is actually a form of mad cow. Britain and many other countries have since banned the cannibalistic feeding of animals to their own kind, and no scraps or leftovers of food intended for humans can be used on cattle farms. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has followed suit, banning the feeding of animals to other animals of their own kind. But cannibalistic products still get through. And how's this for scary? Many drugs and vaccines, including those for polio, diphtheria, and tetanus, may have been made with products that could, in theory, carry mad cow disease. Both Britain and the United States have been slow to act regarding this growing plague. Make sure, if you have to eat a burger or a steak, to cook that sucker till it's black. The leaner the meat, the better your chances. Me, I'm going to stop eating all beef, unless someone can prove to me that the PBB I'm hauling around in my innards can vaporize the damn human brain-eating mad cow parasites. Where's the beef? Nowhere. How to become a Hindu. Entering Hinduism has traditionally required little more than accepting and living according to Hindu beliefs. Among those beliefs is that the cow should be revered as a mother to all because of the nourishing milk it provides. Therefore, slaughter of cows is sacrilegious. Generally, the steps to becoming a Hindu are: join a Hindu worship community, complete a course of study comparing Hinduism to other beliefs, discuss your changed beliefs with representatives of your former faith, and if needed, obtain a letter of release from your former religious organization. Adopt a Hindu name at a name-giving ceremony. Run an announcement in a local newspaper for 3 days explaining that you have severed your ties with your former faith and have adopted a new name. Obtain a certificate testifying that an authorized Hindu priest has approved your entrance into the faith. Other things I have eaten that were meant for industrial use: Pop-Tarts, Tab, Mom's Meatloaf, Tang, Spam, Hostess Pink Snowballs, Stuff Inside Wax Lips, Airplane Breakfast Sausage. I've thought about just moving to California, becoming a vegetarian. No, wait. Not California. Talk about a place with ecological mayhem afoot everywhere you turn. If the Golden State isn't being hit with earthquakes, it's being burned to the ground by uncontrollable wildfires. Whatever the fires don't destroy, the mudslides finish off. If the state isn't experiencing a major drought, then it's being hit with La Niña, El Niño, or El Loco. The West Coast is a crazy place to drop a bunch of humans. I'm convinced that nature never intended for our species to settle there. It just isn't constructed ecologically for our survival. No matter how much sod you lay down over desert sand, or how much water you pump from the Colorado River 1,000 miles away, you can't fool Mother Nature. And when you try, Mother Nature gets really shit-faced. The Indians figured this out early. Some scientists say there was more pollution in the Los Angeles basin when tens of thousands of Indians and their campfires were there than there is now with 8 million cars on its freeways. The Indians couldn't stand the way their smoke just hung in the air, trapped by the mountains. And when the earth moved and split apart, they got the message and got the hell out. But not us. California is our dream. 34 million people, one-eighth of our population, are crammed along a strip of land between a mountain range and an ocean. This means manna to the energy companies, 34 million suckers to take advantage of. Welcome, rolling blackouts. Back in the good old days, California's electricity was supplied by regional monopolies whose rates were set by the state legislature. Then, in the mid-1990s, deregulation was touted as a way for the companies to escape the high costs they'd incurred by building nuclear power plants, and as a way to make much more money. One of the most vocal advocates for deregulation was Enron, a major contributor to the Republican Party, and George W. Bush in particular. Deregulation went into effect in 1996, thanks to a piece of legislation that took a whopping 3 weeks to pass and included a $20 billion bailout payment to the California utilities. most of which was used to cover their bad investment decisions of the past. For 4 years, prices were frozen at above-average levels. But so was competition, which is supposed to increase in a deregulated market. There was a block in effect against new power plant construction, so Californians grew more dependent on out-of-state independent providers for their power. Thus, on and off for the past year, power has been bought on the daily spot market at outrageously inflated prices. Today, utility customers not only pay more, they're forced to go through certain parts of the day without electricity. But it's not because there isn't enough power. The independent system operator, the California agency that oversees the transmission of electricity, has access to about 45,000 megawatts of power, the amount needed for summertime peak demand. The power companies are holding back as much as 13,000 megawatts of this power by going offline, for reasons they don't have to divulge. The Wall Street Journal reported in August of 2000 that 461% more capacity was offline than in the previous year. And of course, tighter supply means higher prices. But this is not the case in those cities served by community-owned utilities. People in Los Angeles and other areas where the public still owns the energy have not experienced blackouts. Other states in the Southwest and Pacific Northwest have sufficient supplies of energy to have bailed much of California out of this recent crisis by providing almost 25% of its power. While all of this Hollywood drama has been going on, Junior and Uncle Dick have been seizing the moment to scare up public support to build more nuclear plants, burn more coal, drill for more oil. In other words, they want to make bad matters worse. Meanwhile, Bush has built a new home on his Texas ranch that is an environmentalist dream. It is fueled by solar energy, and its wastewater is recycled. And Cheney's vice presidential residence is equipped with state-of-the-art energy conservation devices that were installed by the president in exile, Al Gore. Clean, renewable energy is okay for them, but the rest of us get the message loud and clear. Let them drive minivans. Let them eat beef. George W.'s Ecologically Correct Texas Ranch. President Bush may not care about the rest of the environment, but his new Crawford, Texas ranch is shockingly ecologically correct. The house features geothermal heating and cooling systems that use 25% of the electricity of traditional mechanisms. Water at a constant 67 degrees, piped up from a source 300 feet below ground and through the house for cooling in the summer and heating in the winter. The same system heats the swimming pool. A 25,000-gallon cistern that collects house wastewater and rainwater for reuse in irrigating the gardens. Its own water purification system, which uses recycled household water to help restore native wildflowers and grasses on the property. Chapter 7, The End of Men. Earlier this year, my wife and I attended the baptism of our new nephew, Anthony. Our teenage daughter had been asked to be his godmother, a job that would require her to be there for little Anthony should he need to be burped or raised Catholic or both. The baptism ceremony, we discovered, has changed a lot in the Catholic Church. Instead of just hurry up and pour a little water on his forehead before we lose his soul to Satan, the church now makes it a joyful event during Sunday Mass. About halfway through the service, Father Andy asked the entire extended family to gather round the big baptismal font while little Anthony Proffer was submerged in the holy water and then wrapped in a pure white garment. The priest then held Anthony up for all the congregation to see, and everyone in the church applauded enthusiastically. No one was applauding louder than me. For this was the first time in 13 years a boy had been born into our family. 13 babies in 13 years in our family. That's 11 girls and 2 boys. Now, I think most of us would agree that having a girl is, well, a little less work. Not that we love boys any less, and with a strong health insurance plan that covers broken arms, teeth, and collarbones, with additional coverage for fingers caught in car doors and personal injury claims from neighbors who allege our dear sweet little boy torched their Celica just to see how fast Toyota paint burns, they're no more difficult to raise than girls. I have lived my entire life in households where men were decidedly in the minority. I have no brothers, but two wonderful sisters. Between them and our mother, they made sure I did all the woman's work in the house, while my dad was granted occasional leave to watch a Sunday golf tournament. I tried to even things out a bit, claiming I deserved more of a say because I was the oldest. But that only galvanized my sister's childhood feminist majority. To this day, as testimony to their assertive behavior, those who meet us when we're together are convinced that my sisters are older than I am and that I'm the baby of the family. I now live with my wife and my daughter, outnumbered again. Whatever frightening male habits were not exercised by my sisters and mother, these two have been merciless in finishing off. The latest was breaking me of spitting toothpaste all over the bathroom mirror while brushing my teeth. That one only took 19 years. They tell me the list is now down to a single page, with only three or four appalling behaviors left to annihilate. Balancing my big gulp in the open space on the steering wheel while driving, leaving permanent ink stains on the arm of the chair I fall asleep in, snoring, though I fear this one may ultimately only be corrected by a pillow being accidentally slipped over my face and mysteriously held there tightly for a good 3 to 5 minutes.